Live from WNUR News, I'm Brendan Prizman. You're listening to the 6 o'clock news on WNUR 89.3 FM HD1, Evanston, Chicago. It's Wednesday, October 30th, 2024. Tonight on WNUR News, a look into ChatGPT, the most obscure film on Letterboxd, a deep dive into the new movie on Donald Trump, and a look at Northwestern Athletics. Those stories and more coming up on WNUR News. Tonight, we delve into the evolving landscape of academic integrity and technological advancement at Northwestern University. Our WNUR News reporter Edward Simon Cruz investigates the university's strategies in response to the burgeoning use of generative AI tools among students. Stay tuned as we uncover the measures being taken to maintain ethical boundaries in the digital age.
That lead you just heard was written by ChatGPT, the chatbot that took the digital world by storm after it was released in November 2022. Here's ChatGPT describing what it does. Quote, ChatGPT is a generative AI model developed by OpenAI that generates human-like text based on the input it receives, capable of engaging in conversation, providing information, or generating creative content across various topics and contexts. I use ChatGPT to write parts of my introduction, but we can use ChatGPT for many other purposes. Here's what some Northwestern students have said about it.
I use it for a lot of essay-based assignments.
If I'm like having a hard time getting started on a homework, I could like put the code into ChatGPT and it'll explain it. Or if I get stuck, like an error that I can't find, I can put my code into ChatGPT and it'll find like where the error is and like recommend some things that could help fix it.
I think ChatGPT is like a really useful tool when it comes to brainstorming and like creating concepts and ideas, especially for like essays, just having a basis, like an outline of what I want to write before. I think it's really helpful.
I feel like I sort of value my own creativity when it comes to homeworks and writings and things that I feel like I should express my own thoughts. But I do use ChatGPT when I have to get a grasp of ideas, of concepts that was taught in class.
I usually use it more for recreational purposes, for like recipes or traveling.
According to separate fall 2023 surveys from both the Associated Student Government and Northwestern IT, the majority of students use AI at least occasionally or once a month. Some faculty members became concerned about the frequency with which students use generative AI.
We saw a lot of worry on the part of faculty that new tools that were being introduced and sort of rolled out without a huge amount of discrimination as to how the tools should be used made faculty worry that students would use these tools to basically do their thinking for them. And then shortly after the tools were rolled out and the press got hold of them and we started seeing story after story about ChatGPT and OpenAI, the stories about how the large language models very often would hallucinate and create language predictions that didn't actually have any basis in reality, made people worry even more.
That's Victoria Geddes, Director of Teaching and Learning Technologies at Northwestern IT and Chair of the Provost's Generative AI Advisory Committee. Large language models, including ChatGPT, may generate content that is not only inaccurate, but also reflective of social biases.
The tools are trained on the internet and all the data that are out there. And unfortunately, the internet has a lot of biases built into it. And so it's not too surprising that something trained on a biased corpus of material would also display bias.
How did the committee respond to the emergence of ChatGPT? Here's another of its members, Elizabeth Lenahan, Director of the Cook Family Writing Program and Assistant Director of The Writing Place.
Writing is a means of thinking. It's a means of figuring out your thoughts on issues and figuring out what your identity is. All of those things are so integral to the writing process and have the potential to be stripped away if we're relying on generative AI too much.
But according to both Geddes and Lenahan, that doesn't mean faculty members should immediately condemn or ignore generative AI.
I do feel that faculty who teach writing and who teach lots of different things have some sort of obligation to acknowledge the fact that AI is, you know, a part of the world now, and that it is going to be a part of the workplaces and things that many of our students engage in beyond the classroom.
Last August, the committee hosted a series of faculty workshops on generative AI tools and possible ways to incorporate them into classrooms. About half of the students surveyed through Canvas last fall said their professors allowed AI to be used within limits. Some professors created videos about assignments incorporating AI. These videos are available on the university's website. In one video, Ken Alder, a history professor, talked about an instance when students ran an assignment prompt through ChatGPT and marked up its response for errors.
It basically was the most banal Wikipedia version of their project. And so in a weird way, it was a great lesson for them about what constituted research in depth.
In another video, Ignacio Cruz, an assistant professor of communication, discussed using AI tools to evaluate students' resumes.
We can unpack these systems to an extent to be able to show them the role that they play in their own experiences in the job market and beyond.
And Chin-Hung Chang, an associate professor of Chinese, shared her experiences about an essay writing assignment that incorporated ChatGPT throughout the process.
They could learn the language structures from the writing. For example, you can say and, you can say in addition, you can say as well as. So it was a good tool for them to immerse or expose themselves to the language outside the classroom.
What do the students themselves think of ChatGPT and other models built on generative AI?
I think it's a useful tool, but oftentimes I think like the human brain can do better.
I think it's helpful if you use it in the right way. It's a good tool to get feedback on essays and help edit, but it's not great at writing them like on its own. So it's really just like you get out what you put in.
For WNUR News, I'm Edward Simon Cruz.
Most film nerds like to say that they've seen the most underground indie film of all time. But Sophia Kesa has actually done it. She watched Weaver's Crossing, a film with zero views on Letterboxd. Here's her story about that experience.
I feel like we've all gone through this scenario. You watch a movie or a show or read a book, and when you try to talk about it with someone else, they haven't seen it. Eventually, there is an extreme point where you exhaust your list of friends and you just have to settle on the idea that the media you've consumed is at least somewhat obscure. But how obscure can you get with this? I pose this question to two people very familiar with the world of film.
There's a Ken Russell film called The Devils, based upon an Aldous Huxley book that a big studio paid for, that ended up giving, in the early days of the rating system, like an X rating in the early 70s.
That's Kyle Henry, an associate professor of radio, television, and film at Northwestern. As for the other person's most underground film,
probably this French film called Cosmos. There's six vignettes. One of them is about this filmmaker who was really bad at like interviews and everything, and he like can't get his words out about what his films are about or anything, and it's just like his little plot.
That's Angelina Randazzo, a first-year RTVF major at Northwestern. Now, while Randazzo and Henry both have their opinions, a question arises. How can you measure obscurity? Unfortunately, there's no universal tool. However, a good metric can be found in the view counting feature on the film review site Letterboxd. While it's not a perfect estimator, the site hosts around 10 million users, so it's a decent sample size. On the site, The Devils has a decent 60,000 views, while Cosmos has a smaller 2,500 views. Now, depending on your definition of obscurity, you may find these films to fit under that category. But what about obscurity to the highest degree? A film with no views on Letterboxd? Such a film exists in a little place called Jackson County with the 2015 movie Weaver's Crossing. The movie is directed and written by James Ian Mayer, who owns the small production company Moonlight Films, which distributed this project. The story is billed as a dramedy about recently retired Sheriff Henry Turner and his estranged son Jason, who returns home to take his father's job, while an intrepid journalist chronicles their relationship for her newspaper. It's got comedy, it's got drama, it's got good journalism representation, and it was available on YouTube. So, on a Monday night, Angelina Randazzo and I sat down to become the inaugural Letterboxd viewers of Weaver's Crossing. I'll play a clip of our reactions to a scene where Henry has his second heart attack in the 63-minute movie.
No!
Oh, no. Henry, are you all right?
Well, I'm on the floor, so I don't think I'm all right.
Okay, I'll get you pills.
It's not going to work this time. Henry. Chekhov's heart attack.
Take it easy.
How about you call a hospital? Dude, he's actually gonna die this time.
I think I can set up a little bit, maybe.
You're joking.
To put it briefly, it was an experience. Randazzo has her own thoughts.
There was a lot of chances for it to be profound. There was a lot of chances for it to be emotional that they ruin.
Now, while Randazzo didn't care for some of the plot choices, she did appreciate some of the editing.
I mean, like, the audio was always clear. You could always hear what they were saying. There were like weird cuts and everything, but I mean nothing like insanely weird.
So it's safe to say Weaver's Crossing got a mixed review from Randazzo, but she also raised a valid question.
I want to know how this was promoted though.
So how does a film like Weaver's Crossing get distributed and end up on a site like Letterboxd? Kyle Henry, the RTBF professor we heard from earlier, also happens to dabble in self-production and distribution, and he has some answers.
You don't need a lot of money right now to make a film anymore. Digital cameras are so cheap. You know, you can get editing software that's really cheap for your laptop. Making the work can be a friends and family affair.
And this seems to be the case for Weaver's Crossing. The editing lines up with that of most in-computer programs like iMovie, and when looking at the cast list, there are a lot of reoccurring last names. The director, James Ian Mayer, acts in the film too. As for cameras, a lot of technical advancements have made films easier to make.
And I feel that since the means of production have gotten cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, like, listen, you can shoot a good film on your iPhone. The lenses, the 4K media processing, everything that comes with like a newer iPhone, those are more powerful cameras sometimes than what we're even shooting with within the radio TV film department.
Now, while Weaver's Crossing was made back in 2015 and therefore likely didn't have things like 4K media processing, it still looks decent. So filmmaking is easier and more accessible than ever, and more people are making movies. Then why don't we see that reflected in our cultural landscape?
Netflix, Amazon, Comcast have really bought up, gobbled up, swallowed up the competition, and they own huge swaths of the media marketplace. And so it's very difficult to find work that's made by independents or about by independent artists outside of places like the Block Museum, or the Gene Siskel Center, or maybe Criterion Channel.
As well as YouTube in the case of Weaver's Crossing. So we find ourselves trapped in a cinematic paradox. More movies are being made than ever before, yet fewer and fewer are getting seen. Which is why we have swaths of movies on sites like Letterboxd with 100, 10, 5, or even 0 views. Which is unfortunate because we still need the Weaver's Crossings of the world. Kyle Henry agrees.
Just because a film is obscure doesn't mean it's not good.
And after watching this film, even though the plot may have been ridiculous at times, Angelina Randazzo found some things to appreciate about it.
It wasn't as bad as I expected it to be. I think production-wise, it was okay for something that probably didn't have like a budget at all, like just chipping out of their own money.
As for my personal take, Weaver's Crossing isn't Citizen Kane, but it doesn't need to be. Obviously, there was a lot of passion that went into this, and I think at the end of the day, that deserves a lot of appreciation. And I'm glad I could find this film and experience that, because while Randazzo and I may have been the first two viewers of Weaver's Crossing for Letterboxd, hopefully we won't be the last. Now, to take us out, I'm going to play a reaction to the truly shocking ending of Weaver's Crossing. So if you're thinking of watching this movie, which I think you should, you might want to plug your ears.
He just gets hit by a car?
I think that's the end, yeah.
Well, lesson learned.
Yeah, look both ways when you drive.
Wow. Yep.
Wow, Weaver's...
Weaver was crossed.
The Weaver was crossed.
For WNUR News, I'm Sophia Quesa.
Christmas has the Christ Kindle Market, and Thanksgiving has the Macy's Day Parade. But what seasonal experience is saved for Halloween? Reporters Mika Ellison and Sophia Pasqua have the story on Spirit Halloween, where it comes from and why it means so much to us, even though it's only here for 1 or 2 months.
Every year, as the leaves turn color and the weather gets chilly, we prepare for Halloween season. We hang decorations, buy candy, and coordinate costumes. And in malls across America, the worn-out, empty storefronts of spring and summer transform into something completely different.
Spirit Halloween, every fall, takes over the empty husks of fallen companies to spread the Halloween cheer at typically semi-reasonable to a little pricey prices.
That was Medill Senior Kelly Rappaport, a self-described Halloween connoisseur. She has fond memories of Spirit Halloween.
I remember when I was really young, it was like the closest thing to a haunted house because they had all the like electronic decorations and stuff. So we would go there even when I was young and we'd like walk through the electronic decorations, and I remember like making sure they'd all trigger and go off and like laughing because I always liked the spooky stuff.
Despite its transient nature, for Rappaport, the seasonal appearance of the stores was a constant in her life. And lacking federal calendar recognition, one might argue instead that Spirit Halloween is the true indicator of the start to spooky season.
But Spirit Halloween, spent a lot of time there, even with like friends once I got to high school, checking out like costumes and stuff, goofing off with like the masks and things like that, cracking jokes with like the wigs and whatever. But it's definitely, it signifies like, it's finally here. Halloween, it's here. And there's a lot of stuff in my house that's from Spirit Halloween that I think is so old that they don't carry it anymore. But you can still see the, like, old stickers on them. So there's definitely a lot of history there with the Spirit Halloween.
School of Comm senior Charlotte Admacomb remembers that during her time working in a mall, Spirit Halloween would disappear at the end of every Halloween season, reappearing again in the same abandoned storefront, year after year.
Well, to me, it's that store that opens up. It's seasonal. Low-key, you never see unless it's Halloween.
Spirit Halloween is memorable for its iconic costumes and general air of spookiness. It also happens to be the largest Halloween retailer in North America, with over 1,500 locations in 2024. Seasonally, of course. But where does it come from? And where does it go every year once the festivities are over? Admacomb and Rappaport put it more practically.
How do you stay in business? How do you survive year-round?
But I'm just interested, like, what they do the rest of the year. Because I think they also own some, like, Christmas pop-up stuff. But other than that, I'm curious how they make their living the rest of the year.
In the spirit of the season, we took it upon ourselves to find out how Spirit Halloween prepares for its most important and honestly only holiday, and what exactly it does for the other 11 months of the year. The week before Halloween, I ventured a few neighborhoods west of Evanston to Niles, Illinois, to visit a Spirit Halloween store. There, I figured out one piece of the puzzle. Spirit Halloween is owned by Spencer Gifts, the company that also runs Spencer's, an iconic mall retailer. I talked with Spencer's manager, Marissa, who is in her fifth season with Spirit Halloween. We talked about what happens when Halloween is over.
Well, we do pack everything up, so it sits on a pod. But pretty much, most of us go back to Spencer's, or we recruit within Spirit and we take them back to Spencer's with us, which I'm a store manager for Woodfield Mall. So I have my own Spencer's there for the last 4 seasons also. So we try to recruit and get them over there, and then they can always come back to Spirit, which they'll be knowing all our systems and POS and our policies and procedures.
I also found out how they put Spirit Halloween stores together at the beginning of the season.
Unloading trucks, a lot of boxes, designing the categories from head to toe, creating characters, and just making sure the store looks full. So when the guests come in, they get the wow effect.
And the guests really do get the wow effect. Here's Chris Luna, a first-time customer at Spirit Halloween.
I think it's really cool. They have a little bit of everything. They have funny costumes. They have cosplay-ish costumes, I guess you could say. It's really cool. It really is the spirit of Halloween.
And here's store employee Stephen Perkins, who just finished his first week at Spirit Halloween.
It's a good place. If you want costumes, you better get them. You got to get them quick because we're selling out quick, you know. It's a good place, you know. It's a good place.
Spirit Halloween
Halloween may seem to float in and out of our lives like a ghost
and inhabit previously haunted-looking storefronts.
But its employees and their impact on our lives is far from seasonal. For WNUR News, I'm Sophie Pasqua.
And I'm Mika Ellison.
Turning to the sports report, Northwestern field hockey continues its historic season. After defeating Michigan State 5-0 on Sunday, the Wildcats earned their second straight Big Ten regular season title. The win was also Northwestern's 17th straight, extending a program record. Should the Wildcats beat Ohio State on Friday, they will complete the first undefeated regular season in program history. And basketball is back in Evanston. Despite the absence of Boo Booey, Northwestern men's basketball team is still gunning for a third consecutive berth in March Madness. Their season tips off tonight at 7 in an exhibition matchup against Lewis. The women's team, meanwhile, looks to return to strong form after a rough showing in conference play last year. Their first matchup is an exhibition game against Parkside this Sunday night. And taking a look at the weather for tonight, after a windy, cloudy day, it'll be more of the same after sunset. Temperatures will remain in the 70s all night long, even though the skies will be mostly cloudy. Overnight, some rain is highly likely, with thunderstorms projected for 5 a.m. Thursday. The rain should die down by noon tomorrow, giving way to incredibly high winds tomorrow night. Friday will be frigid, with temperatures not climbing into the 50s until 1 p.m. Get ready to get those coats out, Evanston. And in the headlines, Maggie Rogers performed at the United Center on Thursday, October 27th. Her set was nearly 2 hours long, with a disco-themed dress and decor in the background. Rogers also brought Mavis Staples on stage to perform I'll Take You There, one of the 85-year-old's biggest hits. It was the first time performing at the United Center for both Rogers and Staples. Rogers also promised the crowd she'd be returning to the studio to record another album soon. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson announced his 2025 budget for the city earlier today. The $17.3 billion budget plan includes a lot of changes, most notably to property taxes. Johnson's budget involves a $300 million increase in property taxes, which he says is necessary to prevent layoffs of city employees. The city council has until the end of this year to approve the budget, though many members push back strongly on Johnson's plan to increase those property taxes. The budget also includes $145 million in federal COVID relief money to be used for community investment. And finally, a pair of Yankees fans are no longer having a ball. In Game 4 of the World Series yesterday, Star Dodgers outfielder Mookie Betts reached his glove into the right field bleachers to catch a foul ball from Gleyber Torres. But as the ball settled into Betts' glove, a pair of Yankees fans grabbed his hands and yanked the ball out of his glove. The MLB demanded that the Yankees ban the pair of fans from Game 5, which the team did earlier today. Their tickets will go to a youth cancer patient and his family. That's all from WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on Twitter at WNUR News. That's WNUR News. You can also listen to these and all of our other wonderful stories on our Spotify, Google Podcasts, and SoundCloud. And you can also find us on our website, WNUR.news. Again, that's WNUR.news. Our producer today is Georgia Kerrigan, and our reporters are Edward Simon Cruz, Sophia Kesa, Sophie Pasqua, and Mika Ellison. For all of us here at WNUR News, I'm Brendan Prizman. Thank you so much for joining us. And don't forget to join us next time on Friday, November 1st at 6 p.m. And now, back to scheduled programming. Have a great night.